When Meg Gaines was 38 years old and had two small children at home, she was diagnosed with terminal, inoperable ovarian cancer. Her doctor told her to go home and think about the quality, not the quantity, of her days. Instead, she grabbed him by the bow tie and said, "I don't think you understand. I intend to live." And that was in 1994. Today, Meg Gaines is cancer-free, and she spends her days helping other cancer patients stand up for their rights and their lives. Gaines is an attorney and the founder and director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's a nonprofit group that goes to bat for patients with life-threatening illnesses who are denied care by their insurance companies or their hospitals. Gaines told Ann Strangechamp she started doing this work after she recovered from cancer and found her heart just wasn't in her old job.
It wasn't so conscious, actually. When I went back to work, I went back to the same job, which was a great job, but it wasn't, I mean, it was working with prison inmates and law students, and it's a great job, but it's not what I felt drawn to. And what I realized, my oncologist would call me 2-3 times a month and say, "You know, I just operated on this woman, and she's kind of down and depressed, and I'm wondering if you could just come talk to her for a little bit." And so, of course, I would go over to the hospital and walk into a room with hair and, you know, dressed and walking around and energetic. And the greatest gig I've ever had in my life is to be able to personify hope for people. I mean, there's no words for it, how it feels to just be able to walk into somebody's room and say, by your presence, it's okay. You know, there's hope. You don't have to, you know, don't give up now. I mean, you may or may not live. It may or may not kill you. But don't give up now. It's way too soon. And so I'd start to do that. And then because I'm a lawyer and because I'm sort of, I think I've always been kind of advocacy. I think I was born sort of an advocate. People began to ask me for help about things. I can't get this. My insurance won't that. What about this? What about that? And I just realized that that's where my joy was, where I was getting joy was in helping people with something that I knew how terrifying it was not to have help and not to have guidance.
So you've been doing this now, working as a patient advocate, working with the healthcare system for, what, 8-10 years? Are there one or two cases that stand out that really affected you really deeply, really taught you something?
Yeah, there's lots, several. One was a case with a woman who had uterine cancer that had gone undetected for a long time because even though she was bleeding and had symptoms, they kept saying, "Oh, you're just menopausal, you're just menopausal." She was a PhD student in English in her, you know, late 40s. She didn't have any money. She lived in an apartment and had a beater car. And anyway, to make a long story short, she was diagnosed with uterine cancer very late. She tried to get into a clinical trial. Her insurance, which was with a different carrier than her insurance company covered, they wouldn't let her go. They wouldn't refer her for care for the clinical trial. So we began this fight. And by the time we won the fight, sort of, by that time she had mets to her brain and was no longer eligible for the trial. And I remember sitting in her room in her apartment with her. There was a big group of people sort of helped take care of her. And she lived over off Park Street, and I could smell the Chinese food cooking and the lilacs blooming at the same time. I never forget that mix of smells. And watching her die and thinking, you consume care first, and you worry about who's going to pay for it later. You do anything you can to scramble into treatment, but don't delay it, trying to figure out who's going to pay for it if there's any way to avoid a delay.
You said there were several cases that came to mind.
There's another case with a young boy, who's a 3-year-old boy, who was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And his parents spent a short time because they didn't have a long time. So, you know, sort of the big rush always to find out what to do. So when they had decided what care they were going to have, the healthcare insurer decided that they wouldn't pay for that care. So, I remember distinctly talking to his father the night before Thanksgiving on Wednesday night, and he said, "I don't know what to do. You know, we don't have a lot of money, and, you know, they have another kid, and we just don't know what to do. What if they don't pay for it, and am I going to be liable for all this?" And I remember saying to him, "You know, it's not an easy question to answer, but it's a simple question. And that is, what will you do right now for your son that will allow you to say, if the worst happens and he dies from this cancer, we did everything we could? Answer only that question. The rest of it takes care of itself."
You know, this whole system that we're talking about, people call it the cancer maze, but a time when people are really sick and really vulnerable and really frightened, to have to negotiate two really difficult bureaucracies, the medical bureaucracy and the insurance bureaucracy, I don't see how anybody does it without an advocate like you.
I think the answer is people say, whatever my doctor says, that's what I do. And they just kind of turn off. I mean, you're at the worst time in your life. You're most terrified. You're most exhausted. And they're giving you medicine that just absolutely brings you near to the precipice. And you have 4, 5, 6 times as many problems as you've ever had in your life. And I don't know how people do it when they don't have help. I mean, I think the answer is a lot of people don't do a very good job of it.
And the people who've been successful at navigating this system and they've had good outcomes, what do you think are the personal characteristics that some of those people might have in common? What does it take to be a, I don't want to say a good cancer patient, but a successful cancer patient, whether you live or die?
Well, I think one of the advantages that I think some men have, and plenty of women do too, of course, but is the attitude, I guess, that you're entitled to good, competent, high-level, caring, comprehensible, timely care. And if you just exude personality that says, we all understand why we're here, it's kind of amazing how I think the system sort of folds around you.
Well, I would think the reverse, that kind of attitude would sort of annoy
you can't,
and irritate.
It's tricky. You can't act pissy. You know, you can't. You can't be rude or snooty. It's about confidence.
Upbeat, you're saying, positive.
Yes, I think, and strong in a certain sense, even when you don't feel strong. And I don't mean tough. I mean able to kind of be centered and see other people. And, I think...
Boy, that's a hard thing to call up when you're in a situation, because I think cancer especially, people must feel out of control. I mean, look, if I take a car into the mechanic, I know so little about cars that I can't second guess. If the mechanic says you need this $600 repair, I can't say, no, I don't. Mm-hmm. So I'm
And you're not even tired from right. the treatment.
So I'm not in control in that situation. Right. And you're talking about people who are not in control acting as though they are.
So how do you maximize it with the mechanic? How do you maximize it? What's your strategy? We all have a strategy for this, right?
Well, I'm maybe not a very good advocate. I tend to say, okay. But I'm going on whether this person feels like a good, honest, trustworthy person who looks me in the eyes or not. If mm-hmm. they don't, then I'm not going back to that garage.
Mm-hmm. But you might actually have the car fixed right then, right?
Yeah.
Even though you're not going back to the garage. Yeah. Well, I think this is a great analogy, actually, although I hate the car analogy generally because...
Our bodies are not machines.
Right. Our bodies are not machines. We didn't design them. We didn't build them. And we don't know even close to that much about them. But I like the kind of powerlessness in the mechanic and how, kind of how people handle it. And you make what you just described is you make a personal evaluation. You go with your gut, which is an integral part, I think, of evaluating any healthcare also. And then one thing that I do, both at the mechanic and at the, you know, surgeons or the doctors, is if I know I'm having to trust someone because I'm in, you know, stuck between a rock and a hard place and I don't have a choice about it at this point, I look at them and I say something like, well, I'm at your mercy because I really don't know anything about this and I'm going to have to trust you. So I hope you'll do right by me. And it's really, you know, if you have any chance to turn someone who is likely to deal with you less than honestly, if you have any chance to turn them around, I think it's because you say directly, I'm trusting you.
That's really interesting to me because the whole time we were talking, I kept thinking, how do you keep going and stay positive, you yourself, in the face of this healthcare mess? How do you get through the bitterness and the anger there must be at the bureaucracy, the people who are saying, you know, to these patients, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that? And I guess it must be that trust, that basic faith you must have that when given the facts and looked directly in the eye, people generally will choose to do good.
I think probably several things. A little bit that I feel like when you get the right person at the right place at the right time, they'll do the right thing. I think that's often not true, doesn't pan out to be true, either because people don't want to, or because they're not in a position to. They don't have decision-making authority at that level. If it's in our contract that we don't cover double transplants of any organ, and you know, this is one we're running into right now, and multiple myeloma, there's a clear study now out that says a double transplant is much more effective than a single transplant, right? So it's a classic case of insurance contracting not keeping up with medical technology. So I call this, you know, the patient advocate at the insurance company, and I say, hey, you should pay for this. And she said, this is an actual conversation. She said, well, we already spoke to them. Our contract only provides for one transplant per organ per lifetime. And I said, yeah, but that's back in the old days where we didn't have this information. You know, when you made this contract, and we didn't have the information that, you know, double transplant is the standard of care. It's the way to go. And she said, right. She's a nurse, remember. She said, right, right. And I said, so what are you going to do about it? And she said, well, they should appeal. And I said, no, they should not appeal. And she said, you know, they should get an independent external review. So go up through this process that has its own set of problems. And I said, no, they should not do that. And she said, well, why not? And I said, because you should do the right thing. And there's just like long silence. I said, you know it's right, don't you? You've seen the study. And there's just kind of long silence. And she said, well, I don't know what you want me to do about it. And I said, I want you to go back to your boss and tell him you think it's the right thing to do and that this family should not have to fight this fight at independent external review. That's wrong. And she said, I'll get back to you. Well, you know, are they going to do the right thing? I don't know. We're covering our tracks. But in the meantime, I think just telling the truth to people and saying it, you know, in a sense, witnessing the truth and saying to a nurse who's on the other end of the phone, you know, this is the right thing to do and you're not doing it. It's very important. It's very important to stand there and say that. And I'm not the patient, so I'm not terrified and suffering. And so I can say, and I'm not her daughter, so I'm not afraid of alienating the doctor or the HMO or anything else. So I have the, you know, ritual permission to say a lot of stuff that if people disagree, I'm here to have the argument. But if you agree with me, you better do it.
McGaines, I wish every cancer patient in this country had you. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for talking.
Sure. Meg Gaines runs the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her.